Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. You know, big businesses and innovation often occur in unlikely places, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Now, for those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that myself and Startup Hustle are located in my hometown of Kansas City, the 28th biggest market in the U.S., and very proud of that. Now, with that, we've got some really ahead of the curve stuff that goes on in a lot of different industries, and many people probably wouldn't think that one of the leaders in AI and AI startups is here in Kansas City. Now, before I let you know who that is and who I'm talking to today, a quick reminder that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io. That's my company, and we help people build software teams, which is really, really tough to do. We make it quick, easy, and affordable. Go to Fullscale.io to learn more about what we do. Now, with me today, I've got Brian Weaver, and Brian's the CEO and founder of Torch AI, which is a Kansas City-based company that does a lot of really interesting stuff, network-centric AI, delivering augmented intelligence, technology solutions, and digital consulting services. I'm sure Brian will take a little time to unwrap and tell us what all that means, but let's just go ahead and say, Brian, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Hey, Matt, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yeah, and I'm excited. I love talking about stuff, especially things that I only kind of get. So before we get too far into that, how about a little bit about the backstory about yourself and what y'all are doing over at Torch?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think, you know, I was always start with, I was the son of an army brat. I moved around a lot as a kid. Every 3 years was in a different place, and grew up having a lot of respect, you know, for those that have served and you know, sort of part of that whole culture. So I ended up being dropped off in St. Louis, where my father ran a program for the Army. Played tennis at Northwest Missouri State, matriculated down to Kansas City, and you know, had a couple of jobs, got in trouble at work, quit that job, started my first company 20 years ago, and away it went, right? But yeah, I would say maybe I have a non-traditional path as an entrepreneur. I'd say that's probably a pretty fair statement.
Yeah, I think a lot of us do. And you know, sometimes you become an entrepreneur because you're unemployable. which you know is one thing when you realize that, and it's another thing when you make that your goal.
Yeah.
So we've always made our goals to continue to be unemployable, which means that you're forced to rely on yourself.
Well, I tried to start a little company within I had two jobs before I started out on my own, and actually in the first job I tried to start a company inside that company. In the second job I ended up doing a deal for Kansas Speedway. And that company didn't like it. So it was, again, you know, sort of outside the box project. It was a very exciting and fun moment in my life. But that was really the impetus to say, you know, screw this. I'm done being it's time for me to go and see if I can prove myself and, you know, hang a shingle and see what happens.
Well, I've got notes here that say that you bought your former employer. I'm interested in learning how that occurs.
Yeah, it's a crazy story. So I shared with you that I had worked for Kansas Speedway, and it's kind of funny. There's a guy named Martin Minnie that used to work for the Kansas Area Development Council, and my relationship with that organization is long, and I'm a huge fan of guys like Tim Cowden and what those guys do. But they approached my former employer with a project at Kansas Speedway when Kansas Speedway was first, you know, getting going. And I didn't know it at the time, but everybody in town had turned it down. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll do it. Again, being entrepreneurial, right? You see opportunity. So anyway, jumped into that. It was a great success. But my employer didn't like that. So my job was to manage people. And I ended up doing this side project. And I actually got reprimanded for that. And it was like this moment where you get punched in the gut, like this emotional thing. You're like, wait a minute, I'm proud of what I did. I created value for you and for me and for them. And you don't see that. It was this kind of weird, disheartening thing. And so that gave me motivation to quit, and start my first company. My first client was KU. My second client was Kansas Speedway. My third client was Tivoli Jewelry. And had a lot of fun, you know, working with those companies, and fast forward a couple of years, and I'd had a lot of good success, especially in motorsports and NASCAR in particular. And the opportunity presented itself to acquire my former employer. And so literally sitting in the back seat of my brother's car down in Florida on a family trip, I bid on the business and won, and, you know, had the opportunity to sort of buy that company. And actually even later, the gentleman that reprimanded me, bring him back in and have him come work for me later. So it's kind of a, yeah, it's,
I love that.
It's a funny story, and he's a great man and great guy and no hard feelings at all. In fact, I'm one of his biggest fans and a special person in my life. But yeah, like I said, my start as an entrepreneur is maybe non-traditional.
Now, did you, according to my notes, that company was called Medcor, MEDQOR. Now, you leveraged that into what eventually became Torch's software platform?
So I probably started, I don't know, half a dozen companies in my 20s. I'm a curious person by nature. I'm one of those people, and I say this with literally no ego, but pioneering is sort of the word, right? I see problems very quickly, and I see opportunities equally. And that's been kind of one of the things that I've enjoyed. And that's led me into all kinds of interesting things, you know, both positive and negative. I've got as many war wounds as successes for sure, maybe more. Medcor was a company that I acquired in 2009. So this is way after I had sort of gotten started. I was looking for a CFO, and I interviewed a guy named Mark who happened to be the CFO of the Medcor company. And I was really interested in hiring him. And he said, well, yeah, but I can't start with you for about 6 months. I'm selling my company. And so that's how that started. That conversation started. And 4 months later, I had acquired the largest and most sophisticated data business in healthcare, focusing on FDA regulated medical devices. And that's Medcor. And I still own that company.
Okay. Interesting. So did you always know that you were an entrepreneur?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I was the guy that I had, you know, I mowed lawns with my friend, you know, I love working. I remember I got upset that when I was young, I couldn't get a job. I still remember that moment of being upset because I was unemployable because I was too young, but I love to work and I like to be busy. I don't like to sit still and you know, again, that's a blessing and a curse, I guess, but yeah, I wouldn't say I was born to be a business owner. You know, you learn that the hard way. And my joke, you've written a lot of books. I've not written any books, but if I write a book, it will be There Was No Brochure. Because when you start this stuff, you think of all these fantastic ideas you have and how great it'll be to go out and kind of forge your own path. But you realize really, really quickly that it's hard. And, you know, it's painful sometimes, and you learn tons and tons of lessons, sometimes, you know, the hardest way possible. So anyway, I don't know that I set out to be an entrepreneur. I think the concept of Startup Hustle is great because there's a lot of people that want to be. You know, I think I always was a curious, again, like I say, pioneering type person, and it almost happened to me, just out of nature, not out of self-selection, maybe.
So over the last year in my spare time, I've always been fascinated. You use the term curious and pioneering, which are synonyms for innovative and discovery in some regards. So I've been blessed to be around really innovative people from everything. I worked in the music industry for 10 years. And, you know, one of my books is about the music industry. And, you know, we were able to get guys like members of Dave Matthews Band to write our, you know, the foreword and stuff like
that. I'm not afraid to admit that I love some Dave Matthews.
Right. Well, who doesn't? Yeah. And also that's
anybody that's watched 40-Year-Old Virgin would say no.
Well, and then, I mean, and that's just next level shit, man. Cause like okay, it. First off, you're filling up. I mean, it's hard to get like 20 people to show up. 20,000's a little different, but with that, I've been studying in my spare time the traits of genius.
Yeah.
And with that, I learned that there's a big defining line. So first off, there's a big difference between being talented and being a genius. So being talented is being able to hit the target that everyone can see. Genius, the discussion for doing genius things. And here's the thing is like, we will think of like 10 well-known quote geniuses, but we all do genius stuff a lot. Sure. And, but genius begins is the ability to hit the target that no one even knew existed. And with that, curiosity is like the key component. Cause it's that curiosity that, you know, and like, I don't, you'll find that people that do things well, don't ever want to be called a genius. Yes, they just usually don't. And anybody that's calling themselves one isn't.
Yeah.
Same thing with guru. But with that, that curiosity and the enterprising nature that goes with it are two traits that lead to high levels of innovation and lead to people doing things. And it's really because in the end, I'm the same way. You aren't afraid to take chances.
Yeah. Well, I think, you too, if you take care of your customers, like in whatever endeavor it is, you'll end up with some capital and the capital you can use to fuel your curiosity.
Right.
So I was very fortunate, before the show started, we talk about, you know, how the path sort of reveals itself and it really only isn't until you look backwards that you see how all those little dots connect. But I've been very fortunate to have, you know, capital to allow me to explore some of these things. And some of them were colossal failures.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them have been huge successes and you string that together, but it's almost cause I'm running so fast, falling forward. It's just one of those things. I think when you're built like that, you know, and you can again, capitalize on some of that, not be risk averse. And then what you learn over time is to create an environment for the geniuses that I've been able to attract around me. I mean, a lot of my success, I'm certainly a curious person and very driven and ambitious, but I've been very, very fortunate to be able to attract an amazing team of truly genius people from Kansas City.
Which, by the way, is another trait that people that are involved in genius endeavors have is the ability to persuade and get other people. Like, I'd need to hire people that are way smarter than me.
Absolutely.
Because I'm not that guy. I'm not that scientist. You give me rocket science. I built a rocket once when I was a kid and it shot up. The moment it came off the pad, it turned directly towards me and almost took my head off. And I realized that I would pursue other things that didn't involve
burn down
that
the neighborhood.
Degree of math. Yeah. Now with that, the reason I brought this up is because, you know, AI is such a, there's so much territory and everything with it that is, I mean, still remains unexplored. I mean, so what made you want to get into the whole AI scene? And, you know, like, cause if you were doing it years ago, you were very much and the people that are in, that get to start the marathon at the front, it also means you're breaking the wind for everyone else. You're like doing a lot of different stuff. You're making fails here and there, and you got to have a lot of resilience to get through that, I imagine.
Yeah, probably. I mean, what we're doing today is difficult because it's new. We're doing something that no one's ever done before. And that is, it's not, when you get into a business like this, you're not building a business around creating incremental change in a marketplace. You know, you're saying, no, I'm going to go obliterate a market. And here's my thesis, right? So I think this goes back to my very first company. I had actually hired actuaries from Sprint to to build models around sports fans, NASCAR fans, right? And so they would help me predict, and we didn't call them algorithms at the time. You'd call them personas and some of this other stuff, marketing speak. And that was still in the direct mail world. We're not going to, either of us, reveal our age, I guess, today, but I'm old enough to say that my first job, I didn't have a computer, right? So that's the era. But I used actuaries from Sprint to build these models around propensities to buy and spend and renew season tickets and all that kind of stuff. And so I've always had a curiosity around mathematics and data and information, right? It goes from every single business I've ever been involved in. It has information at its core and mathematics at its core. Not subjects that I really, you know, felt any sort of warm embrace with in school or even coming up. It's just something that you've got a bit of a talent for some of that. So honestly, the punchline here is that we got into this space because of basically a massive failure with Microsoft. So I had accomplished this Herculean feat of signing a multi-million dollar contract with Microsoft on an analytics software package that we'd built. And though we made money, it was very difficult it wasn't very profitable because we were, the data was messy, and so it created this engineering nightmare. I mean, you know, with Full Scale, what you guys are doing, you deal with information. I mean, that's what you're helping clients solve problems, information problems, right? Well, the first sort of go at this with Torch was building an analytic platform for Microsoft, and we went literally quarter to quarter, and it was a slog. And at some point, I just recognized that this isn't going to work as a business. It's the economic model, the flywheel's broken. There's massive demand from the client, but we could never get ahead of the information. And so I started running around talking to people, saying, you know, how do you guys solve these problems? And they all look at you, and the reality is they don't solve them. And so it was then that I started looking for some new resources, and I met a guy named John Kramer. And brought John on and to build this new idea for a new software package that we call Nexus today. But basically, it was born out of the failure of Microsoft. And that failure was the data was too hard to use. It was too complex. It was coming at you too fast. And it was too hard to get the information that you needed out of that data. And so we decided to think of a way to process data differently. And we had to do it at machine speed. So the best thing you can do is use, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning and apply it to that problem of data processing. So that's the area we focus on. And again, we're definitely pioneers in the space, and we have landed a lot of huge contracts. But the government discovered the platform in 2018. We won a very large contract for the Department of Defense, overhauling a big system for them using this technology, and it's just been going gangbusters ever since.
I've had quite a few conversations with different founders, you know, regardless of where they're from, that are in the AI and machine learning space. And, you know, much like you mentioned, the data is there and you can process it, you can analyze it, you can look at it. And it seems to me that the real problem that they need to solve is how to, kind of like you mentioned, working at machine speed. It's how do we get it into hands or whatever processes that give us an actionable anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to look back, like you look at, maybe data from like a cell phone carrier and like these things occur and that means someone's going to end their subscription.
Right.
Yeah. But how do you get that in front of the right people to prevent it?
But they can't even get to it in real time. People don't realize. And you get into like things like the metaverse, the concept of the metaverse. And it's actually an approach of how do I create kind of a Disneyland for information where it's all structured but it's not everything. Right. So there's a limitation to that potential.
Well, let's stop for a second. Cause when we're talking about structured data, when it comes to machine learning and data analytics, you have structured and unstructured data. Now, unless your data isn't structured until it's like basically formatted or collated per se, like imagine your spreadsheet and it has all these columns and now it falls in there. Now, data inherently is unstructured until you structure it. Yep. So you know, that's, and that's the first key, because you can't really look at anything patternistic or whatever if it's just like in a zillion different places.
Yeah, in the average enterprise, I mean, first, and not to totally geek out on this stuff, but I live this every day, and so I got a bottomless bucket of nerd stuff. So basically, there's 2.4 IoT devices per human on the planet, right? IoT, your phone thing, digital thing.
2.4
per person on the planet.
So 20 billion.
So you then think, all right, so there's this deluge of data. The volume of information is just ridiculous, right? And it's increasingly complex. And so, again, in the enterprise, they're only able to store and utilize 2% of the data they have. So think about that. They're throwing away 98% because the system's broken. And then I shift over into your structured data comment. 90% of enterprise data is unstructured, meaning it's basically hard to use. It's not tabular. It's hard for me to use it. It requires people and tools and expensive cloud computing and storage in order to even process it. So you end up in this death spiral of messing with the information. I had a client meeting early this morning, and a big, very, very large local company, and the folks there were sort of lamenting the fact that they've got a major problem. They're actually losing business because they can't process documents fast enough. And it's insane. And it's we see it everywhere, and it's because the current mode is flawed. So you go back to structured and unstructured data. Structured data is maybe a little bit easier to use, but the problem is you're blending structured data with unstructured, difficult to use data in some kind of work stream. So that means that some poor soul is labeling things, you know, somebody's opening up a document, reading it. I mean, in PDFs, by the way, PDFs and email are the two largest sources of unstructured data in an enterprise. And it's almost insane to think about. No one's focused on that. And that's our focus as a business. We're laser focused on solving that problem.
I would imagine that some of the large corporations as well have different systems, different things that then create, like, it's not all inherently the same data coming in. And like, I mean, it really is. It's just like, just from a basic programming or building software standpoint, like, I mean, it really is as simple as thinking of it as like an Excel spreadsheet in some regards, but then how do you populate it? And really, honestly, the data is way, 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 way less valuable as a business if you can't do something with it that affects change.
Yeah. What people don't realize is it's like building a building, right? And you're building the foundation of the entire building on top of some sort of information. And so you're structuring that information, and it is just like the foundation. And imagine that the foundation's constantly moving. You would never build a building on top of a foundation that was constantly moving. Yet, what's happening in IT today is that people are creating these massive data engineering and data workflows, and they're built on top of something that's dynamic. And so the minute it changes, they have to re-engineer that whole thing. And again, that's why I call it the death spiral. And there's just, you know, I think in the field of research and researching AI and ML, there's a lot of attention paid to kind of that surface analytics, computer vision, identifying things in information. But you know, we are really breaking really new ground, and we're proud to do it actually in Leawood, Kansas. Every line of code was written, you know, on Kansas ground. But we're focused on doing research and applying these machine learning techniques to making the data easier to use, you know, before. And it will and does make all that stuff that flows downstream easier. You imagine all the work that you guys are involved in, where you've got a client with a workflow issue. And the minute they want to add a data source to it, you got to re-engineer the whole platform. And guess what? That happens all the time.
I talk about that a lot. Now, before we move on, once again, with me today, I've got Brian Weaver. Brian's the CEO and founder of Torch AI, one of Startup Hustle's top Kansas City startups. We probably should have mentioned that about 19 minutes ago, or maybe 20 minutes ago.
We jumped in the deep end,
man. Yeah, well, that's usually the way it goes. You get down the rabbit hole, and it will suck you down while you're also trying to crawl in and out of it. Now, I don't get in trouble with the people I work for here at Startup Hustle, remind you that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. You know, let's talk about that for a second, because I would imagine that, you know, so you look at AI and machine learning, and I think that there's a strong desire for people. I'm sure you're at no shortage of people that want to be involved, but then you have to create your own experts in things this young. Like, people reach out a lot to Fullscale, and they'll say, I'm looking for an AI developer, a machine learning developer. I mean, I have three out of 225 people that I feel comfortable saying are machine learning. Like, they program in R, they have worked in, like, you know, they're doing real stuff that's like real machine learning, as opposed to what, honestly, what 90% of people are calling machine learning.
AI is
more like a ranking database. like, you know, as the founder of Gigabook, a scheduling platform, we do begin to, after you use it for a while, begin to sort your options by which is the most popular. It's not machine learning. It is just literally like, it's a simple ranking thing based on how, that's been a buzzword. And we even came back from TechCrunch in 2019 joking, like, everything we said had a joke about my machine learning algorithm will determine the best dressing to put on my salad at lunch today, guys. So let me get that info back. But, you know, there's a lot to be said. So I'm curious about what's your approach to creating expertise, and also, like, what do you look for in someone because that's a significant investment in a person. So what are, you know, we talked about the qualities of, or traits of genius briefly, like, what are you looking for with people, and what's worked and what hasn't, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I enjoy, as a leader and a manager is building teams. And so I think the first thing is to understand, what does that team really need to do? If it's a team required to sort of solve a problem that hadn't been solved before and innovation's part of it, you've got to really think about the complexion of that. And we actually, when we interview, it's a pretty rigorous process, because what we're looking for is the right mix of people, the ingredients in the team. And so we put a lot of effort and focus around identifying people that are very evidence and data driven, or people that are very structured and sequential, versus people like myself that are more of that, you know, kind of pioneering, you know, kind of entrepreneurial fast mover, to people that actually like to be involved in implementing the technology, right? And so you think about those four dimensions, and then you add this sort of fifth dimension, which would be emotional maturity. So when you're looking at the person, for us, you know, the universities, unfortunately, writ large, not just in our region, but they're not preparing people for cyber jobs or computer science jobs.
My business has grown so
Exactly.
Quickly. I mean, 350,000 open tech jobs in the U.S.
and it's a massive problem.
They're unfillable because we don't have enough people to do them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the universities aren't preparing them appropriately. And most of our people, they end up teaching themselves. And so when we think of, I say often that Torch is not for everyone. You know, we do very hard things. We take the national security mission very seriously. And we need to have people that are not afraid to solve problems in maybe ways that haven't been thought of before. And so when you think of that, you really do need to break it down, and you need to have not just one type of person, but you've got to have a kind of a cocktail of people that can contribute to the project. Because, like me, if I run, you know, just completely unadulterated, I'll cause all kinds of chaos and havoc, right? I need to have people with me. And I recognize this because I'm self-aware, but I need to have people that are more structured, more detail-oriented, can run kind of the operation day to day. And when I get dragged down in that, I'm not at my best. And there's people that's their genius, right? So we have recognized very early on at Torch that, you know, making sure that we've got the right ingredients at the team level was like a critical thing. But at the end of the day, dude, what I want is somebody that has gumption. That's like the one word, and we use it at the company. But it's fire in your belly, you know,
passion.
Yeah. And that can manifest itself in all kinds of ways, right? Because a lot of, especially software developers and technologists are introverted and,
You don't have to tell me that, man.
I
spend a fair portion of most days trying to unintrovert.
And so recognizing,
I'll get clients they'll talk to a team member and they'll be like, "Well, she didn't have much to say." Most developers don't. Yeah, like, do you want her to write code and solve technology problems, or do you? Looking for a spokesperson, because here if you want that.
So this is the thing I think for us, and I'd be interested to hear how you guys do it here too, but I think my job as the CEO is to create an environment for those people to thrive.
Yeah, right? I agree.
How do you do that?
Well, there's a couple different ways. First off, going back to just entrepreneurs in general. So we've talked about a lot of different things here in this episode, and this has been really interesting because I would like to actually talk to you off mic at some point about my journey into what helps and makes people do genius things. Cause honestly, I'm trying to figure out how I can turn it on. Cause sometimes I get it and then sometimes I don't. And then I mentioned, like, I started my journey into this talking to rock stars. Cause at 9:47 on any given Wednesday night, that man or woman has got to do some pretty amazing stuff, usually in front of 20,000 people that are expecting them not to fail.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of getting into that. But the thing I've realized is that passion is that without it, you don't do genius things and you don't do, and honestly, if it's absent in an entrepreneur, their enterprise is likely to fail because they're not, passion gets you through the days that suck. The days where you fail, the days, the coin. So I, in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom, I talk about the coin toss moment because you've had them. Everyone has one at their business where things haven't gone well. And you're like, maybe I'll just flip a coin. Heads, I'll do this. Tails, I won't.
Funny.
Every entrepreneur has had it, whether you want to admit it or not, you know, you've had it in your head or in the office or whatever. Now, realistically, I flip that coin and it's a two-headed quarter, but at the same time, it's the passion that gets you through it. So, you know, for us at Full Scale, it's so much about, so our team becomes our client's team. But what we realize is that when we put people that are passionate about solving the problems that your business needs or has, they perform like insanely compared to someone that's just there to do the job.
Yeah.
So, and with that, like, I'm talking people where you're like, "Hey man, you can't work 70 hours a week." Are they asking you to? No, I'm just really into what I'm doing. I'm like, okay, so you got, rest a little bit.
Yeah.
Now with that, we don't throttle that because we know ourselves that, well, if I'm the same way, like I don't set it down until I get it right a lot of times, which leads to small bouts with insanity on some days or sleeplessness or whatever. The problem is until I get it done or I get it out of my head, the problem is I'm not able to be present in other parts of my life because I might be there, but I'm thinking about something else.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm talking to these guys, like one guy, my friend Jake, who is literally known as a world-class guitarist. And he talks about wanting to complete the work of the greats. So he's looking at like Jimi Hendrix and trying to find the notes that he didn't find and the things that he didn't do. And he gets so obsessive with it. So is there a difference between drive and obsession? It depends who you ask. If you ask my wife, I'm obsessed. If you ask me, I'm driven. So they're kind of the same thing. So with that, the mix of if you put people in and around what they're passionate about, what they're interested in, what they want to do, the results are secondary almost because they're just going to come. It's kind of like people have asked me a lot, and I'm sure you've received the same question from someone in life. How do I make more money? You quit focusing on money. You got to get good at something, and money is like a byproduct of that. Like, I don't think about, hey man, I need to make more money. I think about, I need to solve a problem. I need to create value. I need to provide a service that helps people sleep at night. Cause that, if I can sell you peace of mind, the price tag on that can be about whatever it needs to be. So you start to make people's lives easier or more efficient, help them sell more, spend less. And when you do that, like, I mean, the culture becomes pretty easy because you've got people that are happy. They have pep in their step and they want to and do it.
I think, you know, culture is what it's in a book or quote or something like that, but it's basically culture is what you'll put up with.
Sure.
It's not the candy dish.
But if you're doing something you're passionate about and that you want to do, you're going to put up with the, I mean, all of it as an entrepreneur, an employee or whatever. Now, you can't have like a shitty, combative, like hateful workplace. And
sure.
That ain't going to passion ain't going to overpower that.
But well, that goes back to my fifth little criteria. And I admit that I have my moments of immaturity, right? And that's when you get emotional about an outcome, right? And so everybody's got it. The difference at our company is...
Are you passionate or are you angry?
No. It's not. I draw the line at never insulting and never creating any of that. But I do get you know, fired up about things. And I think it's because we've got something, you know, special, right? And so you believe in that. And I think, again, in a culture, and especially in an engineering organization where, like for us, we put engineers first, you know, and it's a really critical thing. Without engineers, we'd have nothing. And they're the people that, you know, toil every day to solve these major problems, right? And the rest of us, you know, are really benefiting from their genius. But I think creating an environment where you can be sort of vulnerable and transparent, and it's not how I used to be 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, today, I tell the team, I go, hey, I'm having a weak moment today, and I'm, you know, losing myself a little bit in this moment because I care about this. And ask for them to coach a little too, and make sure that they know that it's a safe environment to be able to do that. They can do it. I can do it. And it's not about them. It's more about the job you're trying to do. But I think in our business, where the risk of failure is significant, right? The consequences, like, and especially with some of our defense work and other work that we do, the consequences of failure are grave. And so there's no room for, failure, period. So when you take that, and again, every one of our people lives it, right, too. And we operate with purpose, and they definitely have taken up the torch, as we say. But when you have an environment like that, it's high pressure, you know, and that's why I say it's like, it's not for everybody. But for the people that we have, they love it. And I think it's a special moment in all of our lives. It's kind of that's how I see it anyway.
We use the term critical thinking, a lot to, you know, harbor an environment where critical thinking is encouraged. And that's simply, you know, being able to feel like you can say, hey, there's a problem here and these are some solutions. Or maybe, you know, it's super cliche to be like, hey, if you bring a problem, you got to mention a solution. Well, sometimes you have say, hey, there could be a problem here and we need to figure out a solution.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's one of the things. So when we built Full Scale, our goal was to fix the problems that North American software and tech companies had with offshoring, which critical thinking was a huge one, because a lot of people I talked to have this horror story about, you know, they've got an offshore team and they give them a blueprint, and these people with their expertise, there's no way they weren't building it without knowing there was a broken part of it. But they just said, hey, they asked me to build it, so I'm going to do that. That's an absence of critical thinking, but that exists because either culturally or psychologically or whatever, they're afraid to speak up because they have some fear. And, you know, some cultures are not as sophisticated when it comes to, like, you know, where we might be in the US about bringing this stuff up, you know, like they're just simply have some issues. You look at things like the caste system or things, and it's just not considered wise to tell your boss no.
Yeah.
So, you know, with that is we immediately start deprogramming that. And then another thing we mentioned earlier, that the personality type of a lot of software developers is already introverted. So the speaking up thing is already difficult. So if you create any obstacles to that, so like we start right away, we say, hey, look, first off, we only hire 1 in 40 applicants. So we congratulate them on making it through that gauntlet.
Sure.
And that means you're an expert. And so, you know, the people we work with want and value your expertise. So please know that in any and all situations, they want you to speak up. So we like that's literally within your first 5 minutes of starting at the company. And I think that that's the kind of, now on the flip side, that can be difficult because much like yourself, I am passionate about certain things, which sometimes can be the anti-critical thinking component because people don't necessarily want to trigger it. Now I don't dial my passion down.
Maybe my father, yeah. He was an Army Intel guy and flew spy planes and all this cool stuff. And I remember when I got my first management job, I was 23 years old. And he said, hey, let me tell you a lesson, cultivate a dark side.
Yeah.
And know when to let it out.
Yeah.
So they know it's there, yeah. But they don't ever want to see it again. And yeah. it was a funny thing. And certainly it was a something maybe that's a little more acceptable in the military, but I have come to appreciate the words of wisdom.
You know? Well, and now that exists, but I think that if you get the right people around you that don't necessarily have that ability or skill, they appreciate knowing that it's on their side in many regards.
Like that's true, Brian, too.
My wife just constantly gets after me for speaking up because she's not an outspoken person. And sometimes I'll just, she'll get shitty with me about it and I'll say, you're welcome. You're welcome. You know, or occasionally when she's getting mad at me, I'll be like, I know you want to be able to do that. So I'm doing that, but it's hard. Cause like I said, some people, it's just not an inherent quality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when you're a founder, a lot of the people that join the company join because of the founder's ambition and their plan for the business, right? The potential of the future. It's aspirational when you're in a business like this, right? It's not, people don't join for what it is today. It's not Sprint or T-Mobile. It's not a mature business. And so when people join, they want to contribute to the future, right? They live in the future. And so I think having passion around what you're trying to do is a absolutely critical component of it. But again, I think you've got to create a bit of a decentralized organization where their voice has got weight. Because if you're really moving fast and you value your people and you're creating a great culture that takes care of those people and prioritizes their needs, the command and control model of what the boss says, this is why the mistakes happen in these architecture things that you mentioned. Ideally you're creating a really healthy, safe, positive work environment that gives them a reason. And that comes from avoiding the command and control structure and leaning more towards this decentralized structure where they, at the lowest levels of an engineering team, they're surfacing these solutions, right? It's not just always top down, in this sprint, do this. We're always constantly trying to figure out how to promote and again encourage that kind of thinking and behavior of the team. I think that's if you're building an engineering team, there's multiple ways you can do it, and certainly lots and lots of training and schools of thought around how to run project management. But I think the core fundamental thing is almost treat everybody as an equal when it comes to critical thinking.
That's the biggest challenge we have at Full Scale is because essentially we have our own culture, but then we have to insert our team into currently, almost 50 different cultures and how they do it. And by the way, if you run a service business, you need to make sure you adapt to what your clients do, not make them adapt to what you do.
Right.
And I'll tell you, if you don't, you aren't going to have a whole lot of clients.
Right.
So no one wants to feel like they have to make crazy structural and any kind of changes to their business to do business with someone else. That's not a good model. So, part of that, but with that, you talk about cultivating that dark side. I have literally fired several clients for not treating our people well and past the couple warning shots where I've tried to correct it. And then they're just like, and that's the thing is like our my company's biggest asset is our people.
Absolutely.
Without the people, I don't win awards from Forbes. I don't have one of the fastest growing companies in my hometown. I don't have any of it. I'm just a guy looking for something to do without my team. So I go to bat for them. And by the way, that's known. And that is appreciated, especially in a place like the Philippines, where quite honestly, a lot of our average developer has 8 years of experience. So we are not their first job and they've worked in, they're more concerned about not wanting to come into a place with 12 years of experience where they're going to end up building WordPress landing pages all day. Right. So, that's kind of our commitment to our employees is like, hey, you're going to be challenged. And we literally say during the interview process, if you're not up for that, just don't stop moving forward in the process. Cause you're not going to be. Yeah. Now with that,
good for you.
We want to try to hang on to those folks because sure. Every time they quit, I got to interview 40 more people.
Yeah, I mean that's your model, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's and you know it's interesting because I get a lot of people that'll ask. I turn down so much business because it's not the right fit. Yeah. It's like, you know, and so sometimes I think you gotta, you know, be able to know that and deal with that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. learn those lessons myself.
Once again with me today, I've got Brian Weaver. Brian's the CEO and founder of Torch AI, which was one of our top startups for 2022 here in my hometown of Kansas City. Now, if you listen to the show regularly, you know that I end my episodes with what I call the founder's freestyle, which we're going to get to here in just a second after I remind you that today's episode, Startup Hustle, was and is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. And I say my shows because I'm not the only host of Startup Hustle. Make sure you tune in weekly with Andrew Morgans, the CEO and founder of Marknology, who primarily talks all about e-commerce and Amazon brand acceleration. Don't miss the weekly episode with Innovate Her founder, Lauren Conaway. They just got their 5,000th member. Congratulations, Lauren. And you know, she's on every week and often hosts the top startups episodes with me. So make sure you tune in for those. Now, as mentioned, the founder's freestyle, and it's about, now, Brian, I've had people rap, recite poetry, do whatever, but I like to actually, the term freestyle is mainly to turn over the mic and, you know, these, you know, here we are 44 minutes later and there's a lot that is said and forgotten to be said and passed over quickly. And you can really say whatever you want, or and maybe there were some key points that, you know, you might want to, we bring back around. And I mean, what would you like to say, sir?
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I think, maybe my own, I'm not pushing a book and I'm not, you know, I think sharing a little bit of our story, I think is always fun. And I think what I always enjoy, people that might be thinking about starting a business or pushing forward in a maybe dark time where they're running out of money, and but they still have that passion. All these things I've lived through painfully. Some days. If any of this gives anybody motivation, the reality is you can, you know, in the United States, it's a pretty amazing place that you can have an idea with some gumption and make it whatever you want it to be. And that people will come around you and help support you in sort of these times of need. I think you've got to be a good student of your craft. You got to be a good student of the market that you're trying to help. But I think for me now, and we represented some success here in Kansas City, the fact that we attracted some significant, sophisticated West Coast capital in a market like Kansas City, which we're very, very proud of, the fact that we built software that's really trusted at the highest levels, information security and sensitivity. And we need to band together. This is how you and I kind of got together, right? I think we need to, as a group, try and help create a great environment for entrepreneurs and risk takers in Kansas City. Maybe my little soapbox, my free couple minutes here with you at the end, you know, I think there's sort of this call to arms. Look at what's happening in Kansas City. The lack of investment capital is telling. When I was first building Torch, I remember I would be talking about AI and machine learning, but the way we did it, right? Combinatorial machine learning analysis of data in flight. And they're like, what the hell is that? And what do they do? Instead of being curious like they are in San Francisco. In San Francisco, when I would go out and talk to investors, they lean forward. If they didn't understand, they go, all right, well, what do you mean? Tell me what that means. How do you do that? How do you do this? In Kansas City, there's this attitude like, if what I don't know, I will demean. You know, there's a fear of what they don't know. And that culture here isn't very inviting or supportive of entrepreneurs. Now, for me, I benefited though, right? Because the lack of capital and some of that, it hardened the business. So we became fastest growing, most profitable AI company in the United States, period. Largest, you know, Series A, all that. It all happened because it was hard here, not because it was easy. We didn't take capital until massively profitable. So when you think of that, that's a gift Kansas City gave me. But we, as a group of entrepreneurs and guys that have been doing this for a while, guys, we need to kind of come together and support each other. So maybe my offer is reach out to me on LinkedIn, and I just want to help. I can share some wisdom. Advice isn't worth much, but the war stories can maybe help educate and avoid some disaster. But I think we need to band together and help each other in Kansas City. We've got a huge opportunity. We've got amazing talent in this market. And hopefully Torch is just an example of what's possible.
If for my first sell, well, first off, we didn't mention you did raise $30 million in capital, which in some markets is kind of like, I mean, don't take this wrong, it's kind of like another cap raise. You know, you mentioned in like San Francisco, like now here, that's headline. You know?
Well, for a Series A, the average Series A in 2021 was $8 million. And so that's yeah. You know, nationwide. And so I think for a Series A, for any data company, it was the largest. But certainly in the history of Kansas City, my understanding, I was told that it's the largest Series A in the history of Kansas City.
Yeah, and it's that's like that in a lot of markets. And, you know, so, well, congratulations with that. And kind of filling in a blank with that, I think a couple other things that really stood out is with our conversation today is I really want to just continue to push, be curious about your own curiosity. And you got to try things. You said a couple things that kind of reminded me of my own approach with stuff like, hey, like people sometimes be like, hey, what's one of your biggest failures? I mean, like, I don't know if I have like a huge one, but I got a daisy chain of a lot of like small to mid-sized ones that like hold my beer and like, let's, you know, and I'll tell you a whole bunch of them because my approach to entrepreneurship, like I'm pretty open about defining, I try 10 things hoping one works. I'm looking for a crack somewhere. And when I find it, I try to shove an elephant through it, you know, and it's a very unscientific, but feels scientific in its approach on some days, but you just try a lot of stuff and, you know, like what's your marketing strategy? Test, you know, see what works and what didn't. And we were talking about that before we hit record about how some simple and subtle changes in the way we promoted the show literally doubled the download count in 3 months. Yeah. And you're like, whoa. Okay. So, and, you know, it's, you get, so with that, I just really want to encourage people to not settle in to where you're at because settling in is actually kind of, you're defining and describing a rut. Like you settle into a rut fall into one.
What's
like
the joke when you buy a minivan, that's a sign that you've given up on life.
Maybe. Right?
So it's the same thing with entrepreneurs.
Is that why I haven't bought one yet? I keep refusing.
Yeah. Have you given up on life? No, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, there's nobody that's successful that hasn't had hardship. Yeah. Sometimes it's painful and they don't talk about it, but the reality is it's tough, you know, to do something hard. And starting a business in of any type is hard. Like I said, my book, there's no brochure.
When you said that, thanks for bringing that up actually. Cause that kind of, I want to, maybe I'll write one and we'll sell it as a two part package. Yeah. Cause I want to write one just called No Owner's Manual.
Yeah.
Cause that describes startups. There's no brochure. There's no owner's manual. And that's what makes them hard. Cause like literally from day one, you don't have it. There's not an 800 number that you get to call for your startup. It's like, can I get some help with this? Yeah. No, in fact, you cannot. Plan. Actually, that's what we'll do. We'll start an 800 number that just gives you the tough reality.
No, cause I would take up all the time and nobody wants to hear me complain.
Just be like 1-800 startups. Is that even enough numbers? I don't know. And it's like, it'll just be like, hey man, quit whining and get back to work. You know, that's maybe that'll be it. And you know, I mean, really in the end, and then I think the last thing I wanted to bring up is, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're saying, hey, reach out, contact me. Knowledge isn't something that is meant to be hung on to. In fact, it's toxic if you don't let it pass through you and give it to others. What's easier, climbing the mountain yourself or asking those on top to pull you up? And with that, every entrepreneur I know, and you know, you and I are a similar age, and there's people that have helped you along the way. And I feel like I need to help others along the way. I do it all the time. Like reach out to me. You can email me, deco@fullscale.io. Like I'm super accessible and love the conversation because you got to pass that torch.
That might
just be the right place.
It works everywhere.
So with that, we'll pass the torch along to another date. See you, Brian. Matt.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.
We do it.